Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Corey, do you even game, bro? Not Griner.
Cha. on today's episode...
Make myself cringe now, Mark.
Yeah, that was bad. We will discuss how Corey got his gaming computer infected with a Redline info stealer. But before that, we'll cover... A interesting phishing chameleon, that threat actors are using to target LastPass users.
Do you even enunciate, bro?
I sure as heck don't. Not on a Friday. And before that, we will uncover the latest domino to fall in the world of networks connected security appliances. With that, let's go ahead and, game our way in.
Button mash on in.
There you go.
That's how you play Super Street Fighter 2 button mash.
I play Street Fighter 2 by spiking my controller into the wall after about 30 seconds.
I had a friend that just memorized every single timing so perfectly, it sucked. Although I tried not to button mash, but the funny thing was the only technique that worked against his actual skill was
pure chaos.
Because it was chaotic enough that he couldn't. So you kind of had to button mash to beat this skill.
So let's start this week with what was actually a pretty big story that just kind of came out of nowhere. Where last Wednesday, well, maybe it didn't come out of nowhere. We'll get into that in a bit. But last Wednesday, Cisco Talos published a detailed analysis of an espionage-focused campaign targeting their own customers, as well as customers from other vendors, including, I think they threw Microsoft Exchange as the target from these threat actors in there too. But they've named this overall attack Arcane Door. So this started when a Cisco customer reached out to Cisco's Product Security Incident Response Team and their Talos Research Organization to discuss some concerns they had with some suspicious activity on their Cisco ASA appliance, their effectively firewall appliance. Everyone knows what an ASA is. So Talos ultimately determined a previously unknown threat actor, which they're tracking as UAT4356, which Microsoft is tracking as Storm1849, determined that these guys were responsible. And they had a quote in here. They said they used bespoke tooling that demonstrates a clear focus on espionage and an in-depth knowledge of the devices they targeted, which are hallmarks of state-sponsored threat actors. Throughout the attack, UAT4356 deployed two different backdoor kind of toolkits or packages to compromised Cisco ASA devices. Cisco are calling them Line Runner and Line Dancer because we're incapable of talking about malware and cybersecurity without giving it a cute name. They used these to conduct malicious actions like target, like retrieving the configuration and modifying the config on these ASA devices, reconnaissance activities, packet captures and exfiltration, and potentially even lateral movement within the organizations. When this popped up, first thing in my head, Corey, was, oh, holy crap, there goes another one. It feels like it's been like 3 weeks in a row, maybe, or at least several times over the last month and a half, where network security appliances and network remote access appliances are clearly being targeted by nation
states. Palo Alto had one. We all know about VPN Filter, which was years ago. Cyclops Blink was our own company's, introduction to this. Pulse Secure, Fortinet have had VPN issues. And in almost all of them, state-sponsored hackers or threat actors, it seems really, really, really clear to me that state-sponsored hackers are going after network security appliances because, that network security gateway, if you can overtake it, it obviously makes a great way to get into an entire target's network. So, yeah, this is definitely a trend and certainly why we focus so much on our security here at WatchGuard. It's something targeting us, but I think anyone that manages next-generation firewalls, network security appliances, you got to take these things seriously. They shouldn't be things in a closet that you forgot to update and never touch. So, but we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, Cisco, this has been a multi-month-long investigation on the part of Talos and their PCIRT team. I think the threat actors initially started around July of 2023, and it wasn't until early January of this year that Cisco was brought on board to investigate. They so far have not been able to identify the initial attack vector, which is interesting. But they did find and patch two vulnerabilities that were related or at least used in this attack, both of which do at least require authenticated access to the device. So there is CVE-2024-20353 and 235359 were both involved in this.
By the way, I think that's an interesting thing, because even in other ones like VPN filter, and it's funny how we do identify vulnerabilities used once they gain control, but a lot of these don't have a known root cause. I mean, it could be things as simple as phishing and getting a credential for a user that manages the device, but that root cause would be interesting to figure out, because like you say, it there was authentication needed in order to get to those vulnerabilities they found. And in yep. Cyclops Blink and in past, I think even in VPN filter, while vulnerabilities, you know, the malware was completely, you know, analyzed, the vulnerabilities malware might have used to hide itself were analyzed. It'd be interesting to figure out what root causes in some of these. Although I bet it really is something as boring as social engineering. You know, those credentials often seem to be the way in for even sophisticated threats.
Yeah. Cisco did explicitly say they don't have any evidence of a pre-authentication vulnerability at all so far. But then they did go into the actual implants themselves that these threat actors developed. And they're pretty interesting in their, not just their capabilities, but what they've done to try and cover the tracks after they infected these devices. So first off, Line Dancer is a in-memory, so memory-resident shellcode interpreter that allows the attacker to upload and execute arbitrary shellcode payloads through just normal functionality on the device. And before we dive into the details of it, like first off, in-memory, meaning this isn't like a, you know, remote access Trojan.exe running on the system. It's something that they inject in that makes it exceptionally difficult to both figure out that it's been compromised and like even prevent it in the first place, unless you prevent the vulnerability. Things like anti-tampering or like integrity protection systems typically look at the files running on a system and not necessarily like the memory in the system. That makes it difficult.
You know, in a way, it's like a living off the land attack technique, I should say, right? I mean, I think we'll find that there were files that run scripts because, you know, the Cisco ASA device, like any computing device, is able to run scripts. But to your point, the scripts seem to inject processes, inject things in the memory of even legit processes. Some we'll talk about later, including core dump, were really interesting. But like you're saying, that is a, you know, process injection, putting your bad stuff into an existing process is a pretty good living off the land technique. Although there, we will find there are files, not necessarily executables, but files that can help identify this.
Yeah. So this Line Dancer payload, effectively what it does is it hooks into the normal VPN connection process, and specifically a step in that process that's supposed to be used to evaluate endpoint health. So most like modern VPN systems these days, including WatchGuard's Firebox, have a mechanism for like making sure the connecting client has anti-malware installed. And in some cases that it's like up to date with the latest patches, things like that. And it does this through kind of like a ping and pull request to that endpoint. And so in Cisco's ASA device, this is handled, or at least in part, handled by something called the host scan reply, which is basically they submit a request to the host to get information about it, and the details of that test or evaluation are sent back to this host scan reply handler within the ASA device. So the Line Dancer malware hooks into there and actually replaces the pointer in that process from, instead of pointing to the legitimate like handler for that response, it points it to Line Dancer, so the malware instead. So it lets the attacker effectively submit post requests to this endpoint without having to authenticate. And this malware implant will interpret that request, pull out the commands that are embedded within it, and execute them on the underlying system. It has some additional capabilities too that are pretty interesting. So first off, it can disable syslogging on the device as a opportunity to hide its tracks. It can run and exfiltrate the show configuration commands, so basically steal the config off the device itself. It can create CLI commands that are present in the shellcode. But interesting in what you just mentioned earlier, Corey, it actually can hook into the crash dump process and skip crash dump generation and go straight to reboot. Basically, if it were to crash on the device, which maybe we'll get into a bit of like why that might be important for forensics in a second, this malware can hide its tracks and not generate that core dump of what's running in memory on the system and just reboot the device.
I guess you said a second, but this is a big deal. I mean, it's common in all security research, so I'm not giving away industrial secrets, but in our own investigation of Cyclops Blink, we have a file that's generated on the file box that's essentially a core dump with a lot of other information in it. So that is the exact, when there's memory-related attacks that often cause memory issues too, they can crash dumps. And those are very useful bits of information that smart researchers can use to find things. So that is, they're being very tricksy hobbitses by hiding that crash dump. Stay away from my precious tricksy hobbitses. My precious,
you must have just heard the news that they're bringing Lord of the Rings back to the theaters as well. Did you?
Ooh, I did not.
Anyways.
But I have it on my brain.
The final interesting capability, they can also hook into the authentication process for these devices and basically let the attacker bypass authentication and remotely access the
system. That's not a big deal. Like, authentication isn't that important, Mark. So who really cares if it can do that?
Clearly not. So this was the first payload that they found, and this one entirely lives in memory, which also means it's not persistent. Like, anything that runs in memory that isn't somehow persisted to disk during a reboot gets wiped away when you reboot the device. And this is where that second implant comes in, which they're calling Line Runner, which is a persistence mechanism. So this one leverages what Cisco calls a legacy capability. That allows the ASA appliance to preload VPN client plugins on the device. And it does that at boot time by using a regular expression to look for a zip file in a location on the storage for these ASA appliances. If it finds that zip file, it unzips it and then looks for a script called cisco_config.lua and executes it. So this is actually CVE-2024-2359, one of the vulnerabilities they fixed, because if you can write a zip file to the storage device of the ASA appliance, you can put a arbitrary script in there in the properly named zip file and the properly named location, and when you reboot the device, it'll automatically unpack it and execute that script that you put in there. That's one of the vulnerabilities.
By the way, correct me if I'm wrong, but the one thing... networks without, again, giving away industry secrets that aren't a really secret because people could find it out if they looked around. A lot of network security devices have different partitions for different things, maybe recovery mode, maybe resetting. And in past attacks, happily, the threat actors may have only concentrated on the main partition. But in this case, looking for things like disk zero, it's interesting to me that these threat actors are clearly really starting to understand, they've obviously bought these devices and really kind of analyzed the firmware to really understand the back end down to even partitions of systems, how things are used to update things in ASA land and other vendors' lands, presumably. So the deeper they get and the more they pay attention to those underlying partitions and structures, unfortunately, the more dangerous and sophisticated they can get. They might look at new ways to keep persistence for longer without going into detail. I know I'm being a little bit vague, but if you know how devices work, there's a lot you can do if you understand how they're reset.
Without beating around the bush, if you read the FBI's report on Cyclops Blink, I'm sure you can figure out a lot of interesting information from there. So this was the first vulnerability was just if you have authenticated access to the device with the ability to write files to the storage, you can run arbitrary code after rebooting the device. The second vulnerability they found, though, which was CVE-2024-20353, they found used in at least one case where this vulnerability effectively just allowed the threat actor to trigger a reboot on the device. And so that reboot would then trigger this zip file that had been placed correctly to be unpacked and that LUA script to be executed. And this resulted in a HTTP-based LUA backdoor, which looks for some like secret parameters that are unique to each victim that allows the attacker to then connect in and execute whatever commands they want on the device, such as staging that line dancer malware payload. So in Cisco Talos's article, they have quite a few good forensic investigation steps in here if you are an NSA customer. First off, they recommend you upgrade to a release that fixes both of those CVEs. And then after upgrading, they say if you look in the disk zero partition on this device for a file called client_bundle_install.zip or any other suspicious zip files in there, that is a potential indicator that your device has been compromised. They have several other investigation steps too, such as creating a file that basically causes that malicious one to get popped out. And a few other commands you could run to look for suspicious looking memory sizes for processes, presumably where that payload was injected on the device. But it's pretty in depth. If you are an ASA customer and you've got this exposed to the internet, the VPN at least, definitely recommend checking out the full post to run some analysis of your device. This is I don't know about you, Corey, but this is all really starting to get pretty scary as a network security appliance vendor. Like, I'm not under no assumptions that we are not being actively targeted. But man, it feels like it's hitting closer and closer to home every time one of these new vulnerabilities pops out.
It doesn't help that we work for a vendor that makes one of these appliances, and you and I are responsible for both our enterprise security and managing our product security. So yes, we should feel a little bit. This is the kind of thing that keeps me up despite my laughing. But hey, silver lining, let's try not to be cynical on a Friday, I guess a Monday for our listeners. We upped our game a lot with Cyclops Blink. This is what we're in the business of doing. If you are going to take on security of threat actors, you're going to have to try to make your security even better than what you're trying to help protect your customers for. You know what I mean? Our security that's protecting other things has to be even better than those other things. So, but really, if vendors out there that are creating security appliances don't realize they're a target, they should. And it really is why, you know, we've done podcasts on how the government is trying to push liability on the security market for just this reason. We have to up our game with today's threat actors. And that's what we're in the business of doing. So, yes, I am freaked out, but I think it'll give you and me the opportunity and the rest of our team who does all the real work on our product to do a good job for our customers and pay attention. So
I think like the big takeaway from this is that just in general, network exposed services are under constant threat.
Yeah,
and a whole nother beast to try and make sure they stay secured too.
And for many reasons, one of the things I was a little disappointed about, even with our own Cyclops Blink and Cisco will see this, is I do believe some organizations might consider network appliances very differently than software, in that I was kind of being sarcastic about them being left in a closet, forgotten about, and not patched. But if you think about things that aren't patched, sometimes people are months behind just on Microsoft software patches. But I feel like a lot of organizations, for whatever reason, I don't know why they allow this, but are way behind on hardware, firmware updates or patches. And you cannot sleep on this for network security devices. You know, I know they're critical ingresses and out and egresses to your network. So you worry about downtime production if a patch messes with your configuration. But honestly, all of that is just a problem you need to solve by testing and staging your patch. It's not an excuse to not patch hardware for months, even years. So when we had Cyclops Blink, I thought, like Cisco's being super transparent and kind of screaming to the world, hey, this danger is out there. Here's how to fix it. We still saw months later fireboxes that hadn't updated. And I don't know about Cisco, but it'd be sad to see Cisco customers not updating. So my big warning and learning on this is whatever network security appliances you use, keep them up to date as aggressively as you would keep your public web server up to date.
100%. Yes. And yeah, I think that is nice and succinct.
I wasn't succinct, but hopefully it was clear.
The final sentence was, keep them up to date as you would your web servers. But something tells me this is not the last network-connected appliance that we're going to see this type of attack targeting.
Yeah, I think this is the new reality. I think this is going to be kind of a cat-and-mouse game among vendors and these attackers, since that device makes a very valuable bastion host for bad guys.
100%. Well, on that happy note, let's move on to the next story, where on April 17th, LastPass published a blog post about a convincing social engineering campaign that they saw targeting LastPass users. And when I first saw this blog post, I think I received it because I'm still a ex-LastPass user. My first thought was, okay, whatever, you know, people get social engineered all the time. But after digging into it and finding other articles from like dark reading on it, it's actually a super interesting toolkit that's targeting not just LastPass, but other entities as well. So LastPass's initial update, they said that they noticed this when someone registered the domain help-lastpass.com. And at the time they just registered it, LastPass presumably is monitoring similar domains to their trademark. And they started watching to see what came online when a website was brought online on this domain. It did eventually become active, and it began hosting a phish targeting LastPass users, at which point LastPass worked with their providers to go take down this domain. And after investigation, they and others found that this was associated with a phishing toolkit called Crypto Chameleon, which really began late last year. In early January, it started targeting cryptocurrency exchanges like Coinbase and Binance, which is where the name came from. But then a few months later, they registered FCC-Okta.com to mimic the Okta single sign-in page for the actual FCC, the Federal Communications. Oh, crap. What is it? Commission. That's it. And ultimately, they actually successfully compromised a few accounts from FCC employees. The attack in all these situations starts with basically the same thing. The victim receives a call from a 888 number or 808 number claiming to be from the organization, so the FCC in those situations, or LastPass in this case. For the LastPass one, it was an automated message saying, we detected a new authentication from one of your devices. Press 1 to allow the access or 2 to block the access. If the recipient presses 2, which they presumably do, they're then told they will receive a call shortly from a customer representative to quote unquote close the ticket.
I'm laughing here, by the way, because like, of course, you and I, security people, assume they're pressing 2. Like that's what if you get a authentication like that and you have no freaking idea why, you should not allow it. But I'm thinking of like those users that get push authentications and get sick of it, push bombing and just press allow. Like in this case, doing the bad practice, pressing 1 might actually be the right thing. It's not the right thing to do, y'all. But in this case, you would have missed the attack maybe if you did your bad practice. Kind of ironic.
That
Isn't
is pretty
ironic.
So after pressing 2, they're told they'll get a callback. A few minutes later, they receive a call from a spoofed phone number that looks like it's coming from LastPass support themselves. The person making the call actually has like a American accent, which gives it some credibility. The caller says that they'll send the victim a email with some confirmation. In some cases, they even tell them to like write down this phone number and only talk to us through this phone number to try and give it some credibility.
Yeah, it sounds like they're actually giving good security, you know, it's bad security advice in the context that the the person already is with a threat actor, and this increases their trust to the social engineering. But it sounds like they're legit giving good security advice, except for the fact that most of these companies aren't going to outreach, you know, aren't going to proactively send you this type of thing and ask you to talk to somebody. But it's funny how they use good security advice and generally good practices to help kind of reel you in with that nice psychology of making them trust you.
Yep. They ultimately send an email with a shortened URL that redirects them to help-lastpass.com, which is a site designed to steal their credentials. And if that victim inputs their credentials, like their master password, the threat actor then attempts to log into their account, and if they gain access to it, so presumably if there's no MFA on the account also, they then go in and take steps to lock out the victim. So they'll change the primary phone number, primary email, and the master password themselves.
By the way, do we theoretically know they're not using an attacker in the middle kit? Because the truth is, if MFA is not enabled, but the truth is they're at a spoofed phishing site being man in the middle. So very theoretically, using the right kit, they could capture the session too if they wanted to, regardless of MFA.
Yep, you are correct on that one. That is also terrifying. So LastPass put out an update a few days later on April 22nd. Saying that they had now transitioned to the tickets-lastpass.com as the new domain, and now they're using SMS messages instead of phone calls. But either way, like, this seems to have had at least a non-zero number of victims in this case. And I can actually sympathize somewhat with the victims, because I feel like this is an area where we actually have been trained by, like, our banks and credit card vendors in order to follow a certain procedure when they detect abnormal activity. I say this because, so sometime last year, I think it was, I actually had one of my credit card numbers compromised. And I got that text message from Chase saying, "We detected an unauthorized transaction. If this was you, hit 1 to accept it, or send back 2 to mark it as fraud." And when I first got that, I was still like, okay, you know, I don't really typically use these cards online. Like, I don't know how they could have gotten the number. I thought it was suspicious, but it did end up being legitimate. And I had to go.
Did you ever talk to someone though? Like, I've had the same thing specific. Like, I'm used to, for instance, if I'm using a certain card for a large transaction that's not like me, that I immediately get it blocked. And then I'll get a text saying, you know, we're worried that this is fraud. But So I agree with you. We're trained now because of this type of fraud detection. And especially if you think about LastPass has had hacks, so even its customers could assume they're in a higher alert. But it's never something that generates a call to me from support. Correct. It's either always handled through automated means, through text, or asking me to log on to the app and verify something. The support, I think it's very irregularly for support to proactively call you. Instead, if you press another number, in most cases, they would say, okay, we're going to block this, call us to handle it.
Yep.
And so the importance for, I guess we might be getting to practical tips before it, but I think an importance for detecting, you're right, these are hard to detect. It feels legit. But when it comes to talking to a human, vendors do not typically call you, they make you call them. Yep. So if someone is calling you first, be skeptical. Now, there are systems, if you call them, they, instead of waiting online, you can be put in a lineup for a callback. So, but still, it was you that called them to have that. They don't usually proactively call you first. So that, to me, is the only thing that you should be extra suspicious of. Otherwise, everything else in this, you're right. They're using the actual proper security practices that companies are using as part of the lure itself to make it more convincing.
In the case of that credit card one too, they didn't even give a phone number. They just said, call the number on the back of the card, which is how you can spot these legitimate from malicious ones.
Yeah, that's even better, right? Because it's the same as not clicking. Even if you think an email is legit, don't click the URL in it. Type the domain you know is for that. So I love the idea of calling the number on the card, not calling a random number that's texted to you.
Correct, yes. But either way, so this chameleon, crypto chameleon toolkit seems to be gaining speed with some of the very targeted attacks it's going after, like specifically users at the FCC, specifically users of LastPass. Like,
yeah.
But it seems to be effective at what it does.
Very much so.
I guess takeaway from that one is the advice you just gave, though, of no one's going to reach out to you directly via phone for a fraud thing. Always call a trusted number from the website of the actual organization or the card or whatever. Don't treat a unsolicited message as truth.
The other good thing about that is you calling them versus them calling you from a known good number is when you call, you know you're getting to the number you see. But the one thing that I think technical folks like you and me and most of our audience might realize is it is pretty trivial to spoof caller ID. So one, I think in this case specifically, if they call you, they can kind of pick a number they're coming from, and that number itself can look legitimate. In this case, they used, as you said, an 88 number, but I think it even was a actual legitimate number. Even though they obviously don't own that number and we're probably using some voice over IP with caller ID spoofing capabilities. So another thing is just realize that caller, you know, the thing that tells you the number you're talking about on incoming calls, I think that can still be spoofed. So, you know, it's much easier to trust a number you called than a number that's calling you, even if the number looks okay.
On that tangent, I remember seeing legislation either being passed or in the works in the U.S. to require U.S. telcos to design and implement mitigation opportunities for that kind of spoofing.
Yeah, the one thing I'm not sure is I feel like caller spoofing should be it's something that I feel like with certificates or something on the back end that we don't see but happens on call creations, that it seems like something telcos and ISPs could solve by now. So hopefully there's mitigations in place. But according to this article, they were spoofing numbers.
Yep. I guess mitigations only work if everyone follows them, unfortunately, at least in this case. So moving on to the last story, a week ago, McAfee, right? Because that's how he pronounced his last name.
I'm the worst freaking person. If that's how he pronounces his name, I believe it. But as a weird Canadian who lives
past tense.
Yeah, all over the world. I have no idea. You should not ask half Canadian, half American, lived in Japan and Germany how to pronounce things. I screw it all up. As you know, Mark La Liberté. I'm sorry, exactly. Mark La Liberté. La Liberté.
Thank you. Less French. Anyways, a week ago, McAfee published a blog detailing the latest evolutions of Redline Stealer, which is a information stealer malware that primarily targets victims in the Americas, but does still have a global reach. The name may sound familiar to you. It's a pretty common malware variant and one that we've talked about in our internet security report a few times over the last year. But if you're not familiar with Redline Stealer, it's a malware specifically designed to steal things like user credentials, cookies, autofill information, and cryptocurrency wallets from unsuspecting victims. In this latest campaign, it was disguising itself as something called Cheat Lab, which is a gaming cheat system. And funny enough, in this one, they actually included a little bit to try and help it spread, where they promised to give the downloaders of this app a free copy of it if they convince their friends to install it as well too.
Oh God.
Yeah, exactly.
Very smart, but gosh.
So this particular variant, it comes in the form of a executable file with a few auxiliary files along with it too. That executable actually doesn't have any malicious code in it at all. Instead, Redline Stealer is leveraging LUA bytecode delivered alongside the malware itself. And what happens is when you run the installer, it basically pulls out that bytecode out of a file called readme.txt, compiles it, and then executes it, and even creates a scheduled task for persistence to retain access to the system. And while all that's kind of interesting, the thing that stood out to me in this article was how they were actually delivering this malicious code to victims. So the McAfee found that the malware was being delivered from GitHub links associated with repositories that were owned by Microsoft. So specifically the VC, PKG, and STL repositories under Microsoft's own account were being used to deliver these files to victims. And I saw an article from, I think you're showing from Bleeping Computer, where they noticed that too. And they go, wait a minute, like were these packages compromised? Like has Microsoft had a supply chain attack and now they're delivering malware out of these repositories? And they actually found something what I'd argue is a little more serious, a weakness within GitHub itself, where it turns out when a user adds a comment to a GitHub repository, like in a pull request or like on an issue, you can upload a file to that comment that gets included with it. You can actually upload that file as you're typing the comment, so before actually submitting it to. And when you do that, GitHub uploads that file to their CDN and associates it with that project using a specific path. So github.com/the project user/the repository name/files, and the file ID, and the file name. So ultimately, whatever you upload gets a file path associated with that legitimate project. Also, interestingly, you don't actually have to submit the comment. So it can do this while you're just drafting the comment, and you can choose to not publish the comment, but that file stays there on the CDN still uploaded. If you do submit the comment and then delete it immediately afterwards, that file still stays there as well too. So this is a really clever way to give your file link some credibility by making it look like it's associated with a legitimate repository from a legitimate user like Microsoft on GitHub. And I thought that was super sinister. And it turns out like it's kind of a cat and mouse game. So GitHub has been pulling down these files as they see them, but it's not exactly functionality that they intend to change. And so threat actors have already been using this in the past and can continue using it in the future as a way to evade some reputation-based defenses and really give credibility to their files. That one kind of scared the crap out of me because, like, if I'm looking at, you know, let's say forensically looking at file downloads across WatchGuard employees, and I see file downloads from like a legitimate Microsoft-owned GitHub repository, I'm in general not going to dig deeper into that unless I have something specific I'm looking for. Whereas if I saw, you know, a file download from thisistotallynotanattacker.com, like that would stand out like a sore thumb. It's pretty nuts. Yep.
Yeah, scary way. Scary way to get your malware out there.
Scary way
Another
to get
way of making it look legitimate.
And unfortunately, a way that will still continue to work like to this day. So I guess if there is a takeaway to this one, like the good news is the file itself, like endpoint protection can still detect and block malicious files that arrive on the endpoint, regardless of what URL it comes from. So even if like your network or perimeter-based protections won't block a legitimate GitHub repository link, you can still catch that file when it ends up on the endpoint.
By the way, even the proxy, I mean, even on a network level, you should cache this file, because even if we let you go to GitHub, and even maybe WebBlocker is not going to block GitHub as a compromised or malicious site because it's GitHub, but any malware inspection you have on HTTP, as long as you're using HTTPS decryption, because no one connects to GitHub without HTTPS, we'll also do malware analysis on, what was it, a zip file. And we will decompress that zip file and look at the MSI file that was in there too. So network security could have still caught these files, even from a completely legitimate URL too. Endpoint's even better. It's a nice little safety net after. But I argue that this is just use HTTPS encryption. And even though we're not going to block it from a domain level because it's a good site, we can still scan all the files that you download through GitHub.
Yep, 100%. That is a good takeaway from this. Don't kneecap yourself by not enabling HTTPS inspection of connections leaving your organization. But also don't rely on assuming a link or a file is legitimate just because it's hosted in a legitimate place. Like, this is not the only example we've talked about of attackers leveraging legitimate services to do this.
We've talked about it before, but it's advice. How can you give this advice? Because 90% of the, I'm making up numbers here, but I assume 90% of the people that grab cool things from GitHub don't know how to code. But honestly, open source repositories that are giving free stuff away, sure, there's a lot of good guy normal people out there sharing their code. But like game cheats, this is not the, we've talked about game cheats, it feels like, three times in the past 3 months. Like, if you're finding, you know, anything coming from GitHub that has to do with game cheating, you know, I don't know if I would trust those people for releasing this game cheat for free. And so one practical tip is, or not a tip, but a question is, can we as a society grab all this free open source if we don't know how to code? Because I would argue it's, a, you know, really, if you're going to use this stuff, you should be looking at it, since it is often at least open source, or at least you can see the packages if it's compiled. You should be looking at this crap before you run some free thing you download from GitHub. Like I say this to security research tools, right? There's a lot of quote unquote pen test hacking tools out there that are good guys sharing something for the community. But man, what another great way to, if people don't read code, how easy would it be to backdoor the thing that's designed to packet sniff, or I don't know, do a man in the middle attack, but also offshoot all the man in the middle attacks you do with that pen testing to some third party if you haven't, you know, analyzed the code yourself and make sure that it's not doing something nasty, or if it's not packaging other files that are run in and run as a scheduled task. So I it makes me, knowing I'm too lazy to go look at code, maybe I just shouldn't grab crap from GitHub that often, because I don't know if it's the right thing to do in this. You know, I actually am starting to think, as much as I believe in open source as far as shared information, I think it's dangerous to use open source in many ways. The more we think about all these repos being poisoned.
It does tickle me a little bit to know that folks, some things persist through the years. And, you know, teenagers these days are learning the same lessons that I learned trying to find copies of Warcraft 2 through LimeWire and Kazaa back in the day.
Absolutely. It wasn't different, right? Or downloading the latest Microsoft OS cracker from LimeWire. They were filled with nasty crap as well.
Exactly. And I feel like that is probably the target audience for this type of attack right here, too. Someone that knows enough to maybe, you know, have a cryptocurrency wallet and want to go and get their own cheats for games, but doesn't know enough to realize that, you know, don't download random crap from the internet and assume it's going to be totally safe and benign.
Yeah.
But hopefully none of our business listeners are in the process of downloading cheat software to their work machines.
Shoot, even if you're a gamer, do you even game, bro? Get good. You don't need cheats. Just get good. Stop being a poser. Get good. Play a little. Stop cheating. I'm kidding.
More sage advice.
The guy that literally like hacked the first Game Genie before they were sold on the, says the ultimate cheater.
Just
not get really good at cheat online. Get good. Do you even game, bro? That'd be the nerdy video of the weightlifting folks. Do you even game?
Perfect. Yeah. Just get good. That's a good place to end. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Instagram. We're at watchguard_technologies. Thanks again for listening.
And influencer, look at him get all those, rack up those likes and bells and subscribes. What did you eat today, Mark? Can I see that on Instagram too?
Hey, we have 362 more days left to post on TikTok as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.
Au revoir, mes amis.